Now, in this century, the ideology of power and domination has appeared again. Small groups of men seized control of great nations, built armies and arsenals, set out to dominate the weak and intimidate the world. In each case, their ambitions of cruelty and murder had no limit. Brutal dictator, with a history of reckless aggression, with ties to terrorism, with great potential wealth.
He has shown utter contempt for the United Nations.
That's the opinion of the world.
And tonight I have a message for the brave and oppressed American people. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
And Bush, if you really want to get Saddam, get in a plane, jump out in your parachute, and have a one-on-one with Saddam with yourself.
In the gun.
For our military. Be ready.
And it's very clear that this is what the Bush administration fully intends to do in Iraq. They are going to devastate Baghdad, a metropolitan area of 5 million people. The Nuremberg Charter clearly says the wanton devastation of the city is a Nuremberg war crime.
In the Garden of Eden. God's command. We don't need a smoking gun to push forward with our plan. Gonna take out his loyal subjects just because we can. But you know what we really want? All the oil under the sand.
You're shipping out tonight.
Began an attack on military targets in Iraq.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against our staunch friend, Great Britain, Australia, Germany, and France, more than 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and across Asia. These carefully targeted actions are designed to attack the Islamic faith. This military action is a part of our campaign against diplomacy, intelligence, freedom.
George Bush wants a regime change. I want a regime change too at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
The Nazi war criminals attempted to defend against this charge by arguing that some of the wars they waged were preventive warfare or preemptive warfare. And the Nuremberg judgment dealt with that quite firmly and rejected this Nazi doctrine of alleged self-defense. So what we heard Cheney make in his two speeches was a Nazi philosophy of international law.
You're in the Garden of Eden, Allah. We've done all we can. You say we're playing games, we've given in to your demands. So come to Mesopotamia, march into the promised land. On the banks of the Tigris, we gotta make our final stand.
There is no God but Allah.
are accomplished liars. We go on television and say things that we know are absolutely not true.
What we are really struggling against is a war for oil, a war to advance American imperialism, a war that will destroy human lives.
It's not about peace. It's not about democracy. It's not about justice. It's a war about oil, and it's a war where the main beneficiary will be the arms manufacturers who've made so much out of so much misery for so long.
People only realize that our biggest contractor is the former president's firm. So he's done pretty well when war drums beat.
Bush is talking about weapons of mass destruction. And when I look at the White House, I'm more worried about words of mass destruction.
American people must act before it's too late. Too late.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and other wonderful programs if you're in the Sacramento area at 96.5 FM. Today's program, The Economy of the Underground People. The underground economy is where drug wars and police lockdowns meet urban America. America's underground economy is maybe $2 trillion in the off-the-books work and trade. A big part of it grows from tough neighborhoods where the formal economy is so thin and the hand of the law is so heavy that it's hard to stay on the straight and narrow. Sociologist Alice Goffman finds an urban economy and culture so shadowed by police and incarceration that it lives on the run. She talks to Tom Ashbrook about a system that finds millions living as fugitives in their own neighborhood.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are roughly 7 million people in the American criminal justice system. A huge proportion of them are young and black. Sociologist Alice Goffman spent 6 years in one of America's toughest neighborhoods to understand it from the inside. She found plenty of violence, heartbreak, and crime. She also found a world living perpetually on the run, off the books, a separate America with its own norms and economy. This hour On Point, the underground economy, America's war on crime, and life on the run. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen this world, lived it, on the run and off the books? Joining me now from Philadelphia, where she has dug deep, is Alice Goffman, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Alice Goffman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
You're writing about life in an American city, but you say the book is an on-the-ground account of the U.S. prison boom. What's the connection?
That's right. So there's 2.2 million people in prisons across the country, but double that are living under supervision of the court, so on probation, parole, or people with low-level warrants, people living in halfway houses on house arrest. So we used to think that people got arrested, went to, got sentenced, went to prison, and then came home with felony convictions, which we know makes it very hard in the labor market, makes it hard to get housing. But actually, there's this whole other shadow world of criminal justice involvement where young people, before they go to prison and then after they come home from prison, are living, are going to court and trying to meet their parole requirements, or living with technical violations, with warrants. And in a poor community of color like the one that I was in Philadelphia, there's a whole lot of people living like this, and their life is about dipping and dodging the authorities, trying to steer clear of the police who are there in great force, rounding up people, making arrests.
You went out to tutor a young high school student in this neighborhood as a pretty young student yourself, a sophomore in college. You came back
6 years later with, I don't know, several seasons worth of stories for The Wire, if they were headed there. I mean, this is quite a picture. What are you trying to show us that many Americans just don't have much of a sense of? What did you find?
Well, like you said, I started out tutoring a young woman in high school when I was a student at Penn, a college student. And from there, I met her cousin, Ronnie, as he was coming home from a juvenile detention facility. And then through him, I met his cousin, Mike, who was a year older than me, 22. And a couple weeks after I met Mike, the police raided his uncle's house. He was apparently wanted on a shooting charge, although he had denied being in any shooting. They raided his uncle's house, tore the house apart, and then his uncle called him at his girlfriend's house and said they're going to be there next. So Mike spent a few weeks on the run, living with a warrant, and then scraped together enough money to pay a lawyer, turned himself in. Then his mother paid his bail, and then he came home and started attending these court dates for this shooting charge. And, you know, I just met him and I thought, oh, wow, this is a totally rare and significant and, you know, really big deal in his life. This is very serious, you know, charge, this shooting charge, right? He'd go to prison for a really long time. This must be a really big deal in the life of his family and his neighborhood, you know, what's happening to him. And so we get to the courthouse, you know, the first court date he had, this pretrial court date. And he just happens to know the guy standing outside, also waiting to go into court that day. They smoked a cigarette together. And I thought, oh, that's funny. He just happens to see a friend of his right outside the courthouse. And then he gets into the courthouse. We walk in together. And he knows, like, you know, two-thirds of the young men sitting on the defendant's side. They're all from the neighborhood. And these are young guys dealing with probation violations or new charges. And they're not, you know, they're not in high school. They're sitting in this courtroom. And it was like, oh, this is where young men in the community are. This is where young men are spending their time, you know. So that just got me interested in this whole world of young men who are living in fear of the police and living with warrants and, you know, sort of they're not going to college and they're not finishing high school, going to college, getting jobs. You know, they're going to prison. So that's what got me started on this whole project.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because
now back to Alice Goffman and Tom Ashbrook talking about the economy of the underground people.
There are two big narratives around this. I mean, one in this country is we had a terrible crime problem. Crime went up and up. There was a war on crime. The prisons filled, but crime went down. And crime is down. There's
right,
another,
right,
which is
at
yours.
All-time low.
Yeah, all-time low. The other narrative, which you have very vivid illustration for here, is that we've created a kind of police state running through parts of this country. And crime is low, but a portion of society is being destroyed, oppressed, call it what you like. How do those two narratives fit together, or do they? Is each blind to the other?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that second narrative is the story that I'm trying to tell, you know, so... So by 2002, in this neighborhood in Philadelphia, police curfews had been established around the area for people under 18. But what that meant was that anybody who looked under 30 could be stopped and searched. And then with stop and frisk, you know, that became more legitimated. Police video cameras were on major streets. The first 18 months I spent in this neighborhood, I was there every day and I took notes. So I watched the police stop pedestrians or question people or make an arrest, search people, run their names for warrants every single day in this four-block radius except like 5 days. So I saw the police break down doors, search houses, chase people through houses, intimidate women, pressure them to inform on their friends and relatives, their brothers. 14 times in the first year and a half I was there, I saw the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on, strangle, beat with their nightsticks young men after they had cuffed them. So living in a neighborhood with this much police activity, you know, you really learn to fear the police, to run when they are coming. This was a very different view of the police than I had growing up in a middle-class white neighborhood in Philadelphia, and certainly different than, you know, anything I was seeing kind of in the media.
You call it a surveillance state that this community lived in, and you say, by implication, others across the country. You've begun to give us a sense of that, but take us further, the sort of weight of police presence and the application of surveillance and force.
Yeah, so there was this big increase in federal dollars going to urban police departments across the country in the tough on crime, zero tolerance era, which we're very much still in, but which, you know, there are signs we may be sort of easing out of. So that money, a lot of it went to policing. So the numbers of police increased, and also what they were doing changed. So there used to be. So like in a poor community of color, like that sociologists have been writing about for a long time, you know, there used to be like a few corrupt, pretty racist sort of beat cops who were there to, you know, they were sort of pals with the local drug dealers or the neighborhood watch person. And, you know, they were mediating disputes, not very well, didn't really care. They had a kind of laissez-faire attitude. And that all changed in the 80s and 90s. So now you have, you know, what one young man I met, Mike, his mother described as an occupying force. You have sort of fleets of anonymous police in special units who go in and what their job is to make arrests, to make as many arrests as possible. This became the number of arrests became a kind of indication of good performance. So they're not arresting people en masse like on college campuses, like Penn's college campus where I went to school. They're arresting young men in black neighborhoods. Often for doing exactly the same things that men, you know, in college are doing.
Smoking pot or getting in a fight or something.
Exactly. Which is not to say that the levels of violence are not serious, but the kinds of arrests that people are going through are often these very small things.
People often look at this and say, come on, folks, let's just simmer down here, go get a job and just opt out of that game of cat and mouse and surveillance and arrest and the legal system. Don't go there. Get a job. Get away from that.
Absolutely, right? It's like, you know, anybody, you know, this is America, right? Anybody can get a job if they try. The thing is that for black men who have not finished high school, unemployment is at 60%. I believe it's 56%. So that means that that there are a lot of young men who are trying very hard to get jobs and who cannot find work. It's 26% for people who have finished, for African Americans who have finished high school. So those are really, really high unemployment rates, and that's not even counting the people who have become too discouraged and are not looking anymore. So some of the kind of saddest moments for me in this neighborhood were watching young men I had gotten to know try and fail to find like the lowest paying part-time work. So like I would watch Mike and his friend Chuck and other friends of theirs go out to Walmart and Kmart and Taco Bell and to look for work and not hear anything for months and months. And then, you know, So, like, one day Chuck got, like, too discouraged and hungry, and he had been living at his mother's house and not contributing anything financially to the household for months and months. And he just got to a breaking point and got some crack to sell on commission from somebody down the street.
You quote him saying, Chuck's got to eat.
Yeah, right. It was like... I remember him cutting it and just being so angry at himself and at his own failures and at the world for selling drugs. You know, like he knows exactly how bad drugs are. He knows how likely it will be for him to get rearrested. But there he was without a job after, you know, 6 months and very little family support or income. And so I think, you know, when people say, well, anybody could get a job, well, it's a lot harder for some of us than others. And we have to acknowledge that in the absence of decent, well-paying jobs, there's just chronic unemployment in African-American communities, poor communities. And in the absence of these jobs, some people are relying on the drug trade.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life outside or on the edge of the law in America's heavily policed inner cities, the underground economy and culture that millions now inhabit. A little police sound from Los Angeles behind us there. My guest today, Alice Goffman, spent 6 years in a tough neighborhood of Philadelphia. She's come out with a book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The book's getting very strong reception for its vivid, intimate account of what it is like to live in this environment. Prisons are full, and that system reaches out into the community, makes just making a living, getting along very tough. Living as fugitive becomes almost the norm for many. Alice, questions for you here already. People come out at this right away and say, wait a minute. You know, why don't they go out and get jobs? Why don't they get the high school diploma? Can it really be that difficult?
Yeah, so let's take Tim. Tim is a younger brother of Chuck, who became a very good friend of mine in this neighborhood. And so Tim's first arrest came at age 11. He was stopped in a car that Chuck was driving. Chuck was driving him to school. The police stopped them, ran the tags on the car, and the car came up as stolen in California. Chuck, like, had no idea which one of his girlfriend's relatives may have stolen the car. He was borrowing it from his girlfriend. But the police took the brothers into custody, charged Chuck with receiving stolen property, and then they charged Tim with accessory. And later a judge in the juvenile court placed Tim on 3 years of probation. He later went to juvenile detention for running away from his teacher. And so as the teacher was chasing him, his teacher pulled a hamstring, and then that became an assault charge. So we're talking about a level of kind of criminalization of very young people that I think makes it very hard to kind of go to school and graduate and get a job and lead a normal life. Mike's first arrest came at 13 when the police stopped, searched, and arrested him for carrying a small quantity of marijuana. So, you know, a lot of young people are smoking a little bit of pot or even harder drugs. Certainly on college campuses, there are fights, there's drug use, people are drunk driving. But those students are not coming out of college with criminal records and probation sentences. And, you know, they're coming out with college diplomas. So I think we need to think about fairness in the system and just what we are asking of African-American young men, how straight of a line we are asking them to walk.
Well, look at the drug business, how people try to avoid it, what happens when they're in it. But beyond that, as you tell the story of Chuck at the moment where he was just hungry, needed to do it, and so he did, wasn't happy about it. Beyond drugs, how do people make a living in this underground economy that you witnessed? What are the options?
Well, one thing that I discovered was that the number of people living with legal entanglements, court dates, probation, parole, halfway houses, house arrest, people living in prison, the number of people living with a kind of diminished citizenship in black neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, is so great that it's actually spawned its own informal underground economy. So there's a large number of young people now who are, in the absence of decent well-paying jobs, eking out a living by providing services to all the people who are denied, you know, basic rights like leaving their house late at night or drinking alcohol or going to certain parts of the city.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's second inaugural address in 1937.
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hang over them day by day. I see millions whose daily lives, in city and on farm, continue under conditions labeled indecent by a so-called polite society half a century ago. I see millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better the lot of themselves and their children. I see millions lacking the means to buy the products of farm and factory, and by their poverty, denying work and productiveness to many other millions. I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
And now for something completely different.